Sequoia presents Judging Dredd, 13 essays analyzing 2000 AD's most beloved and reviled character. Forward by Matt Smith. Interview with Rob Williams. Edited by Scott Weatherly. Find out who is the law. Well, my guest today, I love it when I get to have a creator on. Normally it's me and one of my other nerd friends nerding out, but today I get to nerd out with the creator of the book. This is from the great company TKO. If you're not reading TKO stuff, what is wrong with you people? They're just putting out great stuff. So I'm going to be honest with my guest. I did not know who you were, sir, until this comic. So the whole world will know who you are now after this comic comes out. So, Juni Ba, welcome to Indie Comic Spotlight.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, this is so very exciting for me because it's such a great, thoughtful book. And that's what my show is. It's like a deep dive show. And you've got so much meat on this bone that like you could spend an hour just talking about the first issue and still barely scratch the surface. So we'll just have a long rambly conversation about stuff. And because I'm an English teacher, my thing is, I think I know what's happening and you are the creator, so you get to tell me where I'm wrong. Will that be fun? I'll say like, I think it means this. And you'll be like, meh, wrong. That'll be great. Yeah. I love when that happens. Yeah. So because that's the whole beauty thing. That's the thing of art, right? Is that you put it out in the world and now I get to have my interpretation of it. But How rare is it that we get to talk to the creator to ask that question, to say, what do you, I think this. And sometimes I've talked to creators and said, they're like, oh, that's cool, I didn't think about it. Or sometimes they're like, what are you on? That's not even, did you read this book? So we'll see where we land. So the first time anybody's ever on and as an introduction, nobody just accidentally becomes a comic book writer, and you're the writer and artist of this piece. So there's a love. And in the back of this book, there's a picture of little adorable you holding Voltron, which is amazing.
It's a Spider-Man robot.
Is it a Spider-Man robot? I've got the digital copy. Was it really a Spider-Man? I thought it was Voltron. Yes. It even better. Oh, well, anyway, there's a little adorable you. Oh, see, I didn't zoom in. It is. Oh, that's even cooler. From far away, I'm older than you by a lot. So, do you know what Voltron is even?
Yes.
Okay, I thought it was Voltron, but it's a Spider-Man robot, even better. So we'll talk about how this little guy came to be you. What is your comic book origin story as a fan? And then how did you turn that love into a career?
Okay, how do I usually tell this? So basically, I've always had comics, mostly French and Belgian comics, because that's, I come from a country that has French as one of the official languages. So the easiest stuff to access was the French stuff. The first few comics I had were either volumes of like 45 pages, which is sort of the usual classic way of making comics in France. Now we have a lot of different formats, but at the time that's kind of the classic format that my parents knew. So they gave me a bunch of stuff that they would either buy for me or that they already had. So it's the classic, Asterix. There's my favorite one is a Belgian character called Spirou, who's a Belgian character. He's a little redhead boy who goes on adventures around the world. And so I just started with those on top of, when I was a kid, I found a very old magazine of Batman the Animated Series comics.
Oh, nice.
Like very old, because basically I bought it when it came out, I guess, when I was like in the 90s, but then I forgot about it and then found it again. So that's one of the very old stuff that I had. And it was a mix of comics and cartoons for me at the time. Then the 2000s arrive, we get access to manga. My interest in comics really started to grow when I was around 14, I think, because I've always been reading them. I was an avid reader of a French magazine called, I think the English name would be Mickey's Magazine, which was a Disney branded magazine where you had all kinds of files about all kinds of things, and you had a bunch of comics. Most of the time, it was either Disney comics or strips from licensed stuff, like stuff that they would get both to fill the magazine and have make it a publicity for the full books that I could not buy because I was not living in France. Right. So I would always get pieces of things. Whereas when manga showed up, I always grew with the anime side of things. I had maybe one or two volumes of Dragon Ball in my house, but when I reached 14, 15, I walked into one of the two libraries we had in my hometown, and I begged my grandmother to buy me volume 15 of Shaman King, because a friend of mine had shown me a few books and Shaman King had just grabbed my attention, and I begged her to buy it for me. I had carefully chosen it because I wanted one where I would be interested in like tracing the drawings.
Oh, nice.
So, and on top of that, when you go to in those libraries, you don't have everything. So instead of having the full series, you just have a selection of a few books of a few series, and you just kind of pick and choose and make do with what you have. So the main difference was that manga was fully available in not so legal ways on the internet. And being able to read that meant that my teenage years have been spent reading an enormous amount of manga, really learning a lot of how to tell stories from the Japanese side of comic book making. And then I always knew that the American side, like the French side I knew because every time I went to France, I would buy one or two comics that I knew about. But again, this whole thing of like, I had spent my entire school year reading manga on the internet. When I got the opportunity to buy a volume on paper, that's what I would buy. So basically, because it was difficult to have access to the French and American side, especially on the internet, I didn't care about the American side of things until I was maybe 17 and discovered that Hellboy was a thing.
Wow, that's what an introduction.
I don't even remember how exactly. I just know that like I found the book and I was like, I know the film. I quite like the film, especially the second one. It's one of my favorite movies, but I didn't know.
So good. Golden Army is so good. Yeah.
Like I didn't know it was a comic book. So I just discovered the thing and I thought, wow, that's like, It just slapped me in the face, I guess, especially because I was starting to grow extremely dissatisfied with my drawing ability because I could never be as careful and precise as the manga artists that I liked, especially in terms of like background design and everything. It was always so meticulous and I was extremely upset about it. And then I found Hellboy and I was like, you mean you can draw like blocky, big, shapy things and it looks good? So like I begged the family member to buy it for me because again, living in Senegal, you have to find solutions. I got it for Christmas, the first volume, devoured it many, many times during the same year, went to France for the summer and bought, I think, three or five more volumes and that I still have. I bought the entire series in French, in fact, and I traced and analyzed and observed everything. And it was at the same time where I rediscovered the Gorillaz.
The band?
And started actually, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah. And Jamie from Tank Girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. So again, I knew them from when I was a kid. I had seen a few, like I was the kid that my dad would call me in front of the TV every time the Gorillaz was on because I wanted to look at it again and again. And you didn't have the same internet access as you have now where you can just Google the thing. So, yeah, I then When I was in my late teens, I did have the internet. So I watched the video clips over and over again. I would, again, trace the things, trying to understand how it's drawn. And from Hellboy and the Gorillas, I started looking more into the American and British side of comic books. And then I moved to France, tried reading the Marvel and DC religiously, was pretty underwhelmed, and moved more and more to the indie side. And I guess that's the crash course of like how it evolved. There was the big realization when I was when I was 10 or 11, when I watched the opening animation of Sonic CD, the video game. And I was so blown away that I was like, yeah, I want to draw. So the first few comics that I made, I was 11 years old, and they were Sonic the Hedgehog comics. and that's when I said I want to do that for the rest of my life. And the only rule, the only thing my dad said was, you can do whatever you want. You just have to work at it and be good.
That's awesome. What encouragement. Because it's so many artists you hear, they do it in spite of their family, not with their family support. So yeah. That's great. That's so awesome.
Yeah, I'm really fortunate in that sense. Like from what I understand, my dad had to go through the whole ringer of the very cliche thing of the African parents telling you, you're not supposed to do this, you should follow this direction. So he didn't want to reproduce it with his own kids. And by the time we arrived, my granddad had also changed his ways, and he encouraged me to, and he was on record. He was heard saying that maybe he made a mistake in discouraging his children pursuing their dreams. But he said something like, maybe we killed some careers that could have blossomed. And my dad was very upset about it.
Yeah. Yeah, because your dad's thinking like, hey, man, I'm one of those people. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But my dad is working. He created his own job. He always functioned with the beating of his own drum, you might say. And he himself said that the reason he created his own job was because he didn't like receiving orders from people. So yeah, he was a big influence in like, do what you want to do, but also I witnessed him working very late every night, both because he loved it and still does, I think, but also because he had the work ethic of like, you can't be a slacker, I guess.
Yeah, well, if he's telling you do whatever you want, just be good at it, I think that's the ultimate lesson for anything that you do, whether it's art or, you know, architecture, or I'm a teacher, whatever. Dave, don't half-ass it. You know, go and be good at the thing that you do. So, and you are, you know, but that's good. Maybe because that makes you feel like being good is enough. It's attainable. You're like, I'm going to work really hard and I'm going to learn to be good. And you also reading Hellboy, but also reading some of the manga stuff, which is obviously a totally different style, like you said. And of course, you don't realize when you're a kid that one panel, that one manga panel you saw had like five people working on it. You know, it's like there's one artist credited, and you only find out later. You're like, wait, they had background artists? That was somebody else doing that? That's not the way it's done anymore. But
I was very upset.
Yeah. But you know, but it's cool though, because you see that good is different. There's different types of good. You know, like your art is stunning, and it's like you said, I see that Hellboy, that Mike Mignola, you know, influence there. You know, it's like, you're like, well, good thing I didn't pick up Kingdom Come, because we would have spent a fortune on watercolors and you know, because everything would have had to be painted. So, you know, it's funny how the influence is, because obviously Alex Ross is also amazing and very good, but good in a totally different way. So I think art affords levels of good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the big thing for me with Hellboy was that, because I was feeling so insecure about my ability, I was so influenced by one, not even one, because like there are many different types of manga styles. They don't all draw the same way, but there's always this sense of like, I was ignorant as well, meaning that I assumed, I don't even know why, like the concept of drawing on the piece of paper that's quite large and then scaling it down for printing, I didn't think of that. So in my mind, they were drawing at the size that I was reading it in. So I was dumb, but
I thought it too. No, every kid thinks it. Every kid who loves comic books, at one point in time, took a blank piece of paper and drew six boxes on it, and then tried to draw. Everybody thought it was all thumbnails, and that was the final. Everybody thought it. Yeah, for sure.
And you're like, how come I can't fit everything I want in this panel? He managed it. But when I do it, like, I would need to draw with like a needle or something. Anyway. So yeah, I was dumb and ignorant, but the Hellboy thing was good because it sort of it pushed me into a direction that turned out to be much more my speed in terms of I'm not a very precise artist, I guess. And I like thick lines and I like blocky shapes. And it just so happened that like at one point, I think I had a realization of like just scrolling down a website and looking at different pieces of art and be like, I love this and I love this. And every time I'm like, I want to draw like him. No, I want to draw like him. And the two guys draw in completely different ways. And I realized actually what I was drawn to was that they had found their style and it just happened to work for them. And so it became very clear to me that what I needed, rather, was try to identify what I like in both those guys and try to mix it to get to my own way of doing things. And yeah, that was really freeing. Like the mixing Hellboy, gorillas, and manga was the three, like, just putting them in the blender, and that's how you get the way I draw, I think.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I loved gorillas. I when they did the one album, the Plastic Beach, where they were all three-dimensional instead of the 2D gorillas, I didn't like this album is fine. But like the shows that the stuff that went along with it, I didn't like it as much because it freaked me out a little bit, honestly, to see like to see 2D in three dimensions. Like I'm like, whoa, I don't want to see her like that. But also, like I loved like that old. The way that they originally did it, where it felt like old school cartoons and it felt like Tank Girl, you know, to me, I'm a big Tank Girl fan. And so for me, you know, Hewitt's that part of it came so alive in the gorillas world. So I think that's great. And now that you say that, I look at you, I'm like, oh, I see that. But you wouldn't know, you know, if you didn't know, you wouldn't know, because what you have done is created your own, your very own distinct style, which I think is important. I mean, you want to be recognized, you want to hear it and go like, oh, that's George Harrison playing guitar. But you also don't want to like have that be the only thing you can hear. So you've got a very distinct art style, but you're also telling a great story with that style. So I think that's really important too. How did you come to write then? Because you've written this too. So what was that? You're like, at what point were you like, I just don't want to draw other people's stuff. I've got my own stories I need to tell.
I think it's a mix of I've always made stories. So to this day, like when I was a kid, I started telling stories with my toys. Nice. And I was quite upset when I discovered that Marvel and DC had an interconnected thing where all the characters had different adventures and they were all in the same universe. I was quite upset because I had been doing that since I was like five. And I was like, I don't see how that's super original. I have been doing this by myself. I have an entire continuity of like I can tell you all the different wars and all the different big historical events, and I had like the technology and the society evolving over time, and like I could tell you stories of Action Man and Buzz Lightyear fighting some guy from space, and you know, like the sort of story that you invent when you're a kid. And the other thing was because I grew up with a big French and Japanese influence at first. The idea of a solo creator was much more normal to me. I didn't even question the concept. It's actually when I started looking into the American side of things in my late teens, and I discovered that the whole division of labor was a more common thing in America. I was surprised. I was honestly quite surprised, because to me, that's not that it doesn't happen on the other sides I was used to, obviously. But the idea of a creator doing everything was much more the norm for me, I guess. The European side of things especially has the big creators who are doing, if not everything, almost everything, or at least the writing and the art. So it was kind of weird to me to like look at a selection of Marvel books and being like, yeah, if you want to read this book, you have to, you can follow the writer or the artist or blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, why is it so divided? And a lot of this is a division of labor to produce more things quickly. But I could sense a sort of lack of unified voice, I guess, from the different things. And so the end result will vary, I think. Like my, in terms of my enjoyment of things, I would find that certain books benefited from being made by multiple people. Other books did not benefit from it.
No, that's true. And there's also like when you go, you look way back, there were like shops, like Will Eisner had his own shop, right? And like Bob Kane had his own shop. And so you were, not only were these artists, it was all piecemeal too. They all were trying to pretend that they were somebody else. So you're losing, because it's not just are the, like the one person's writing all the scripts and that person's got like 10 different artists, but they're all supposed to pretend that they're the, that they're him drawing it.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that's not going to work because then you're not being really creative at all. And what's the point of being an artist if you're not, you know, creating anything? So no, I see what you're saying. And I think, but you have done some of that though. You have done some art for other writers. So
yeah,
how did you like that? That process, because you were, you know, were you given a lot of creative control or was it like, nope, just do the script how I'm telling you to do it? Like, what was the process to making that turn to draw somebody else's words?
It depends.
Okay.
It depends a lot on the writer you have, I guess. Because like for now, I made a book that was published in France that was like 200 and something pages, which the script was not satisfying to use at all because of many... It was adapted from a book and I ended up in a situation where I was rewriting after the writer.
Oh.
Because there was a bunch of stuff from the book that he just completely omitted and that was so important to the story that I had to put them back in and so do my own spin on them. I basically had to readapt what he was adapting. Plus the fact that I just got a general sense that he was, because he was told this is a book for 11-year-olds, he was writing it like they were 5.
Ooh.
Yeah, and it just wasn't interesting or satisfying to do. So I kind of vowed since then to never again work on a project just because the opportunity is there. So since then, I've done a few things for DC. I've worked on two scripts for DC. I've worked on a script for a 48-page story that hasn't been announced yet, so I can't talk about it too much, but that was a blast. Mostly because it was really well written and I had enough creative controls. Like the thing I always ask the writers, if I can, is just describe what's going on and let me do the rest. I don't need you to tell me this is divided in so many panels or whatever. I can figure it out for myself because I don't write my own scripts, for example. I don't write them. I draw storyboards directly. My scripts are literally a super long canvas and I draw the panels or the moments one after the other. I make notes everywhere and then I just move the pieces around until I'm satisfied with how it
works.
That's
amazing. What a cool process. That's so cool.
Mostly because I think of it visually first and I think of story in terms of beats. And once I'm satisfied with the way everything ties together, I can move to the storyboard phase. But yeah, so I generally ask writers to not describe the paneling or anything. Just tell me what's going on. I do the rest. And the best experience I've had working on something was a book that's not out yet because we're not done with it. I have the coloring to do. It's been going on for ages. It's a book called The Unlikely Story of Felix and Macabre, which is a book about the worst sides of masculinity, I guess. It's a book about monsters and wrestling and a little boy who meets a super old wrestler who was so obsessed with being the manliest guy around that he sort of cut ties with everyone and has difficulty expressing himself and he ended up alone. And Hassan Osmanel Howe is the writer of this. And that was the best script that I worked on, both because the story is great and I cried a bunch of times and because he writes it exactly how I want to be directed, I guess.
That's awesome. Well, I can't wait to, that book sounds amazing too. So I can't wait to get my grubby hands on that, but you said you're still coloring it. So it's going to be a little while.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and you colored this, the one we're going to talk about today. You colored that yourself too, right? Oh man, I think coloring is so important, and it's like I always say, it's like the score to a movie. You know, like the coloring really can tell us, help us how to feel certain ways. And so, you know, like when you think about Star Wars, I don't know if you've ever seen clips of Star Wars without the John Williams score. It's really a bad movie. Like if you've ever seen Star Wars without John Williams, he's the star of Star Wars. I mean, everybody, you know, it's all great. I love Star Wars. It's my earliest memory in life was seeing the original Star Wars. Yeah. But without the John Williams score, if you get a chance to just to try it, there's different clips without, you're like, oh, this is just bad acting in a desert in Tunisia. This isn't very good. Oh. It's, you know what I mean? And then you're like, oh, that John Williams story, you're like, oh, this is something. So I always feel like colors are the same colors, and your colors in the book we're going to talk about. I'm glad you did them. So I have some thoughts on the colors, but I think, I think it really helps us feel. And I know not every artist has time to do their own colors. And some artists say, only I want to do my own color. So with this job that you took, was that something you asked for? Or did they ask you like, hey, do you want to do your own colors?
Oh, no, they didn't ask for anything. I just showed up with the thing already half made.
Oh,
nice. They just kind of had to let me go with what I had prepared.
Once they bought it.
Yeah. The project was going to happen whether I found a publisher or not.
Oh.
Because I wanted to make it and I was going to make it regardless. So when I showed up with it and I said, do you want it? They said yes. And it sort of just... Sebastian said that he wasn't quite used to working this way. but it worked out pretty well. So yeah, I it's quite funny to like send a pitch and sort of say, well, I'm the only person on this.
It's all me. Everything is me.
Yeah. You're going to have to deal with it.
well, let's get into it. So that's a fascinating. So you are quite inspirational, my friend. That's amazing. I love it when artists just do it. You know what I mean? There's something about art, like creators I'm working on. And what's interesting is you're saying with Jellia, you were going to do it no matter what. I'm putting on the finishing touches of a novel right now that nobody's asking for. And it's such a weird, you know what it's like when you're a creator like that, when you're like, I'm just going to sit alone in a room and I'm going to do something that nobody's asking for. And then later I'm going to say, hey, do you want this thing I made? It's such a weird, art is weird that way because most art isn't done on demand. It's done because the person says, I have this story, I have to tell it. So I love that you were like, I'm writing this anyway. So halfway through, I'm going to pitch it. That's so cool. And so it ends up at TKO, and we were talking a little bit off air. So I'll just start there before we get into what the story is. TKO, the best thing about TKO is they drop everything all at once. They don't do, even if they're individual issues, you get it as a full box with all six issues. And I got this is coming out as one, right? This is just a graphic novel. Or are they going to put them in six different issues when they get?
No, it's just a graphic novel.
Yeah. And was that always the plan? Like was that why you pitched to them? Because you knew they would allow that? Would you have been okay doing this as issues?
No, it wasn't. The thing is, there was a bunch of other stories that could have ended up in the book.
Mm.
The reason they are not there is because they were not tied to the main plot. So I had to take them out. But the thing is, when I was pitching this, and that happens with everything I pitch, I don't really know where it's going to end up. And I want to keep the options open. So initially when I pitched it, it was supposed to be in the usual TKO system. So it was supposed to be five chapters separated. And it just so happened that they had a graphic novel line that they were preparing. So I pitched it as a miniseries. And they said, well, actually, that could perfectly well be a graphic novel. How about we just do it that way? And I said, yeah, sure, why not? And yeah, so that's just how it happened.
That's awesome. They're really cool. I mean, I love everything that they do over there. I have yet to be disappointed by anything that I've read from TKO. They really are leaning heavy into, we are facilitating creators as opposed to we're dictating to creators. And because like you said, you came to them and are like, it's just me. And they're like, cool. That's one check we have to send out instead of six. So it all works out better. Well, Okay, so we don't want to spoil anything because this is just coming out. We're recording this in July. People will be hearing this towards the end of July. This book is coming out. We don't want to spoil because we want people to go buy it. So what's the elevator pitch of it? And then we'll get into some of the themes that I hopefully won't spoil too much because I love, like I said to you off air, I read this in one sitting, and everybody, when you get your hands on this, set aside a few hours because once you start, it's a quest. And you don't want to stop. And so, and it's such an interesting way to do a quest. So that's one of my things I wanted to talk to you about. But tell everybody that's kind of like the pitch of what they're getting their hands on.
So Delia is a fantasy book. I generally describe it as a fantasy action adventure book in a fantasy world inspired by the folklore of West Africa. It's in a world where an evil wizard who once ruled the world decided suddenly to break it into pieces, but with a push of a button. He destroyed every kingdom that was there and hid away in his ivory tower with his hundreds of wives, and nobody ever saw him again. And since then, people have been living on the pieces of world, trying to survive in a world that's now quite literally fractured. And the story follows the prince of one of the kingdoms that was destroyed as he's trying to figure out who he is. And his royal storyteller and counselor, Awa, is trying to make him into the king that he's supposed to be, someone who can pick up the slack after the king died and reunify the world into the great, perfect place that it was when they were children. And they go on a journey trying to get to the top of the tower, trying to simply meet the wizard and ask him why he did it and try to figure out a way to make things better. And on their way, they start to discover more about the world and that a lot of the stories that were told to them were not necessarily all completely true. And that to better the world, they also have to understand the education they received, the stories they were told, the power of those stories, and sort of reevaluate their own values before they can try to impart them on others.
Yes, there you go. Everybody, this book, it's a slow, Junie, I have to say. I'm a book nerd. I've been reading since I've been 3 years old. I've been reading comics since I was 11 years old. I'm a teacher at a university. And this was like, you wrote this book for me. That's what it felt like. I felt like it's written for people who want to spend their time thinking about what they're reading. And I love, like, I mean, you've got the Superman robot picture and obviously there's something to superhero comics, but you know, like manga, there's a lot of action and adventure, but there's always like another story. There's always another layer. And this book is so layered. And you can read it just as what you described it. It's a straight action adventure. There's literally a hero's journey. Literally, you watch a journey unfold. There's a hero. The hero grows and changes. It's like, you know, Campbell 101. It's all there. But as a person who just wants to say, like, what's under the onion? What else? There's so many great secondary stories there. And you touched on one of the things there. So I do want to go there. The ivory tower idea. So in America, and I don't know if you were aware of this when you called it the Ivy Tower or if it was just like, So in America, everybody who doesn't know that the Ivory Tower is the name for higher education here. It's like, if you're in the Ivory Tower, you are, you're somehow air quotes above. Like, I'm technically a member of it, but I don't feel that way. I make my students call me by my first name. You know, we read comic books in class. You know what I mean? I'm not like, there's only three dead white guys that you need to read, you know? So,
yes.
But that's what the Ivy Tower is. It's that guy who's like, there's only three dead white guys you should read and everything else is crap. So for me, you know, the way that you completely break down, formal education and have this conversation about what you said, point, there's a bunch of stuff we didn't know. We thought we knew, but we don't know. And is it because we're uninformed or is it because we've been told the wrong thing? And what I get from this is we don't know because we've been lied to by the people who are in charge of the knowledge. Am I wrong? Is that the right read?
Yeah. I would say yes.
Okay.
There was a lot of, I mean, I think one of the big inspirations for this was the discussions I would have with my dad when I would come back from school and sort of just talk about what I was taught in school. And I went to a French system school. So when you go to a French system school where you live in a previously colonized country and you go home to your Senegalese dad and you tell him what you were taught, there's a good chance that he's going to not necessarily tell you that they lied, although sometimes that happened. but that's why it was interesting to me. It's not they lied. It's they conveniently forgot to mention this and this and this. And so I would get a sort of a second lesson from him about whatever subject it was that the school would just not tell me, either because they want. Either because the system was trying to hide it or simply because it didn't have the time. And it always brought some new light on things, more context. And especially when it comes to colonial history, there was a lot of like...
there was a lot of gaps in that.
They gloss over a bunch of stuff and then you come home and your dad tells you about some massacre that happened where you're like, oh, okay. So yeah, it was a big influence for this. I think that the whole it's not a lie, it's a convenient omission and manipulation of the facts.
Yeah, and it frustrates me because as a teacher, as somebody who's trying to educate people. I never ever say I'm the holder of all things. I say I want to introduce you to these things and let's have a conversation and let's talk our way through it. And I've got some ways to point you, but I still want you, especially as a writing teacher and as a literature teacher, I want you to get there. I need you to get there on your own. And we also know like history, and you just mentioned, especially in a country like, you know, where it was a French colony at one point, and you know. The way that we were like, we're gonna just have our own mythology there. And so it's interesting to me that you're dealing with myths, but there's these modern myths that you're also deconstructing, like the modern myth. So like in America, the most absurd modern myth is like Thanksgiving, as though these European settlers came over and they and the natives all just had turkey and corn and everything was great. Yeah. And you're like, but wait, where are all the natives? Where are they still? If everything was getting along, wouldn't there be a shit ton of them? Oh, no, there's not. But that's the myth. That's the story. And every November, yeah, we all sit around and pretend that's the story and it's bullshit. So what I love for you is that you're leaning hard into like actual, you know, folklore, but this concept of modern day folklore, of the way that modern day education creates its own myth. That if we tell enough young people that it's true, then it will become true, even though it's a lie.
Yeah.
What did you say? A choice to not say things. We're going to omit.
Lie by omission. A convenient manipulation of facts.
So you were lucky enough to have a dad to sit down and have. And so I'm curious how much of those, your friends, your colleagues, your classmates didn't have your dad. They didn't come home to your dad. They didn't have those conversations and have the good relationship that you had. So how much of that is in there? Like not only are you acknowledging the truth is out there, to quote the X-Files, which this is not, but you're also to acknowledge there's other people who believe the myths and believe the lies, hook, line, and sinker, because those people are in here too. So how did that go then for you personally? You'd go back to school, you'd have arguments with your friends. I assume you're like, well, my dad said, and they're like, what are the teacher says, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of that in here where there's like, your characters are kind of bickering with each other, or the different villages they go, they have different versions of the truth. So how much of your life is in there then? Because it seems like that's how we all are. You know, we all experience learning in a different way based on where we are geographically.
I would say a lot of it, but the funny thing is I didn't need to go back to school necessarily, because like, again, the whole nuanced thing is that my dad will tell me something that the school didn't want to tell me, and he will teach me things. And then on a completely different subject, he would be the ignorant one who doesn't want to change his mind, which is even worse because he's much older, and I've been known in certain circles as someone you don't want to argue with, and that's because I grew up with a dad who, like, if you wanted to argue a point against his, you had to come prepared. You had to have, like, receipts. You have to have proof of accounts and, yeah. and I mean faithful one, like, not faithful, trustworthy. The paradox of it, I guess, is you start to realize that people have blind spots, even if they are very knowledgeable about other things. And it's this whole thing of you're a child, and the older you get, you start to realize the cracks in your parents' personality. You start to see their faults and the things they don't know, and how stubborn they can be about certain things. And, like, one of the running gags in my family is how boisterous my dad gets when he's been contradicted and he doesn't have any arguments, and he starts to explain things that, like, in ancient Greece, the master would be listened to without question because respect. To which I almost want to say, yeah, in ancient Greece, they also practice homosexuality, and in this country, nobody likes it, and I don't think you like it either. So, yeah, it's one of those big things. Like, it's the huge paradox of knowing that someone can be so knowledgeable about some things, but also so ignorant and stubbornly so about other subjects. And if you try to change their mind, it's really complicated. The way, just if it's a core component of their personality and idea of the world and of themselves, it's even harder. Like, if their view of the entirety of society is based on something, and that something turns out to not be quite true, there's a blockade almost that you can't pass through. Like, talking to a religious person who has a certain idea of the world, and if you go against, like, if they start explaining, like, that happened to me a bunch of times on both the Senegalese and the French side of my families. Someone will start explaining something based on their religion, and I will just explain with, like, facts and historical events. Even just, you know, that the reason this practice or this idea exists is because of this historical context, and they're like, they don't care. It's been accepted as the truth, so that's how it's going to be. And they can be on the other hand, they can be like, I have, like, a minister of health in my family. I have people who work in the UN and other things like that, and yet they still have blind spots of that nature. And I just find that fascinating.
Yeah, well, and that was what I was going to say, is that I think what you just described is, and I think this runs through the book, is some of the characters are willfully ignorant and some of them don't know. And I think you keep using the word ignorance, and I think that's the right thing, because there's those times where you're like, it's just a blind spot. It's just something that I'm willfully choosing to not look. And other times it's like, well, I just didn't know because it's, and I'm open to it. And so you've got different characters in your book who are open to learning, and there are some who are closed to learning. And obviously, yeah, to learn, the lesson of the book is be open to learning, be open to being wrong. There's this whole thing in the world, and this is what I loved about the book, is how people, even our main characters, as we see them change throughout the parts. You know, when you go back and you reread it, you're like, oh, you know, this is how you were acting in part one, and now here you are in part five, and you've grown so much, mostly because you've said, I was wrong about something. And that yeah, there's this, and I don't know how it is in Europe and how it is in Senegal, but in America, I'll tell you, nobody likes to be wrong for some reason. And it's so annoying, like, because how can you possibly be right about anything? But you address that kind of plague of I'm always have to be rightness, yeah, that exists. And so I think that's really smart. I think there's such a great lesson there for people to be like, oh yeah, I can see myself in this character, and they're all real honest. So how important was it to you as you were creating these characters? Everything you just described with their own blind spots, but their own truth, they all end up being pretty self-aware by the end. Did you know that's how they would be by the end, that they would be aware? Or as you were writing it, as the story was progressing, did you think, no, at the end, so some people aren't going to learn lessons. Some people are just going to be as stubborn as they, yeah, were at the beginning.
I didn't know yet.
You didn't know.
It was like, I struggled with the ending a whole lot. Mostly because I sort of knew where I wanted to go and what the big revelations and everything would be. But also, like, it's this really complicated thing because you have, on one hand, you have a mystery. The whole who's the wizard, what does he actually look like? Because everyone has a very different idea of who he is.
Which are great. Happened. Those ideas of what everybody thinks. Yeah. That's really great. Yeah.
Yeah. So you start with that. You have a mystery and you know how the mystery is going to be resolved. But at the same time, you have the story you want to tell and the arcs you want your characters to have. And you're sort of trying to balance everything so they mesh together and don't clash. And in a way that doesn't, like, that's not obvious. Like, you don't want people to guess your mystery too early. I struggled with it a lot, especially because I didn't exactly know how I wanted the characters to, what kind of conclusion I wanted them to come to by the end. And it sort of happened by, like, they sort of did it by themselves. Like, there's a point where your characters sort of tell you what they think and how they would react to things. And I was quite happy because at some point I wasn't exactly writing. I was just doing what they were telling me. Like, I had created situations, and the way I had written them, they were supposed to react a certain way. And I'm just sort of lucky that the way they react and the way it finishes is very organic. And the characters get to a conclusion that I agree with and feels natural for everyone involved.
Yeah, even though you do have an epilogue, there's still room for growth. It's like, they're not done. Their story's not over. So, like, generally when you put an epilogue on something, it's either like a to be continued, or it's like, I don't want anybody else to write the sequel, so I'm going to write the epilogue, and then it's over, right? Those are the reasons for epilogues. It's like, but you still give us room for them to grow, for us. I love a book that when I'm done with it, I need to, like, well, what happens next? What's this like? And I don't want you to necessarily tell me. I think when you make a good story, then the reader is going to say, or the viewer, if it's play or whatever, movie, the person receiving the art gets to spend time with them after it's over and gets to let them live. And you've given them such a journey and left them in a place that you're like, well, they're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. So we know there's going to be more to come if we want there to be, you know, like for we as the reader. So I appreciate that you, because that's life, right? And
yeah,
this chapter of my life is done. I no longer work at this place, or I finished this book. Like, you finished this book. And if you never come back and visit them again, this will always be part of the next thing you do.
Yeah. And I mean, I have ideas for, like, sequel. I have ideas for, like, sequel stuff. Mostly because, like I said, there's a bunch of stuff that didn't make it in the first book. And I think it's a world that's really convenient to tell a bunch of different stories. So I have ideas, I have directions, especially for Awa, because she's the main character of the book. And even that didn't necessarily start that way.
Really?
Because I mean, she's in the position of being,
yeah.
So she's the heart of it. She's the one that's most directly connected to everything that's being discussed in the book. And I sort of found it really interesting to take the concept of every story that I used as inspiration for this was always centered around a prince, a king, that kind of thing. And the counselors and everything were always in the background. And I just thought it would be fun to have a story where the one who you think is supposed to be in the background, the helper, turns out to be actually the person who's most geared to tackle the situations. And it grew into a whole pseudo commentary on the usefulness of royalty in the first place.
Yeah. And I have to say, the feminist, like this is a very pro women book. And I really love the way that there's the line, and again, I don't want to give too much away, but when there's a reveal towards the end, and the way that the gendered aspect of the reveal was so awesome as a father of many girls, it was really cool to see. And your main character, because it's funny not knowing that, to me, she was just the main character. It was her story, and she's dragging these other idiots along with her. You know, I mean, I know she's on his quest, but it's her story. Yeah. It can't go without her. So So I love hearing you say that. It's almost like you rewrote Don Quixote and made Pancho the star instead of Don. Yeah, that's awesome.
And the gendered aspect wasn't, I almost want to say wasn't supposed to be there, because I just wanted to have a boy and a girl. I didn't think I'm going to have the girl take more prominence or anything. It wasn't, there was no agenda, as the complainers would say. it just happened to go that way. And the even towards the end, the presence of the female characters in the book wasn't made to make a comment on gender. It just sort of became, you know, it becomes an element of it simply by virtue of the fact that they're there. And I actually had to like pay attention to a bunch of how I was writing the things, because there are certain depictions that you want to try to avoid when you do certain things. So that one was not a challenge necessarily, but it was kind of a fun thing, sort of like I have this girl who isn't even supposed to be there, because in the traditional culture, women are not supposed to have the job she has. And I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to have a girl anyway, I don't care. And so, yeah, the gendered aspect wasn't supposed to be there. I managed to keep it in the story in a way that I like and that works with it. But it wasn't written in a way where I was like, I want to have a girl to have some message about it.
Right, but that's the beautiful thing about art, is it wasn't your intention, but if you want it, like if it's there for those of you who want to feel uplifted, you know, because because it is uplifting, and because there is, you just told a story that was true for you, but because you didn't say, wow, that's like you just said, she shouldn't even be there, but you decided just by making that choice. And I know you said agenda in the dark, like in the deep, scary voice. I think it's okay to have an agenda. I have no problem. Have an agenda. It's your art. Have an agenda if you want to. If John Lennon had plenty of agendas. Come on. So for me, it's like the fact that but that was a choice that you made. You're like, I'm going to have this. And so because you did that, that's beautiful to say. I just stuck a girl in there because I wanted it to be a female character. And then it turned into this other thing. And again, because I don't want to spoil, but it is lovely and I loved it. I really goosebumped at the end. I'm glad I didn't stop. It was getting late and I just like, I'm going to finish. I'm close. I can't stop. And I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad I read it the first time through in one sitting. I didn't the second time through. I did it in multiple parts, but because I already knew. But I still appreciate your willingness to not worry about it, to say like, this is the story and this is how it ends. And I'm not going to take that out because I don't want to piss somebody off. You're like, this is a story. It's a story.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the first things I had to grapple with when I started doing these kinds of stories based on West African stuff, was the whole, there's a lot of pressure, I think, around the depictions of certain groups. And it can cripple you in many ways creatively, because you're afraid of doing something that's going to offend someone or disturb someone. And I just decided to put those concerns aside and just tell the story I wanted. The one rule that I had was I don't mind offending, but I do mind being harmful, which was kind of how I approached it. So I would very often reread chapters, try to make sure that I didn't do anything that I would find actually harmful and that would have an actual negative effect on society or something. But beyond that, I had the story to make, and I was quite satisfied with the way it ended, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think there's a difference between being critical and being mean. And I think there's nothing mean in this. I think even the way that the ivory tower gets punched in the mouth like it deserves, and you're having that running commentary about it, and it's just popping up everywhere, and you're like, you again. But even that's not mean-spirited, because like you said earlier, it's like some people just, you can be the smartest person in the world, but you have a blind spot and you're not necessarily, you know, being malicious about it. You're just being ignorant about it, and lowercase ignorant, not uppercase ignorant. And so I don't think this is mean at all. I mean, and again, I don't know West African, you know, folklore. So this is something for me, I just got to learn and get to really have a great time. And It's interesting. Just out of curiosity, did you write it in French? Like, did you do the English? Because your English is amazing, as you well know. But did you do the English translation too? So is the and do you feel that the French version and the English version that tell the same story that you need them to tell?
I don't know yet. Started it in France. I started it in French because I wanted to publish it in France. Then plans changed, let's say, and I started quoting the English speaking side of things, and so I had to rewrite half of it because that's where I was, and then I wrote everything else directly in English, and it does change the way you approach concepts a little bit because the French and the English don't speak the same way, so even the way you would phrase certain things is different, and so it doesn't convey things the same way. But I think, by and large, when the French translation happens, it shouldn't be too different. And then I hope I get to do it myself because the way Senegalese people speak French is very specific. So I wanna do it by myself just to make sure that it's not. Just so I can make sure it doesn't sound like it was made by a white Parisian.
That's very important. I hope it's your work. That's the beautiful thing about TKO. Nobody else can have it. It's yours. So I assume if you're like, no, this is me. This is my translation. I don't think they can. Hopefully they can't say no. I think that's really important too. I do want to talk a little bit about the art and the coloring because we said we would. And again, if I keep talking, I'm going to start spoiling. So I love this story. And as a writer, the story is important. But as a comic book nerd, the art. So you talked about kind of like blocky, chunky lines. But there's these people that you've drawn. Every character, even your background characters, are so expressive. Honestly, is it because is that due to the fact that you're drawing it before you're doing the words? So if you took the words out, you could still know 90% of this story because you're like, oh, she's mad. She's happy. Like she's, you know, like body language, like you, these are the most expressive, like I feel in just brought into there. So when you're writing, because you, as you said, you kind of write on a scroll and you're making notes off to the side. Is that what you do? Like, does your original sketch have that kind of facial expression and body language in it, or are you just rough sketching like scenes and then the people are added in after?
It varies a bit. Very often my mind imagines the scenes visually first, so the blocking of every pose is more or less set, and sometimes I just go freestyle. And I just put like vague shape, like this is where the character is supposed to be. I'm going to figure out the position later. There's a lot of acting, I guess, like trying to like put myself in the mind and the pose of the character, trying to get a gesture going, which is why when I was working on the book I'm doing with Hassan Otsman El-Hao, the story is quite tragic and it's based on personal experience for the both of us. So like redoing certain scenes, I was like crying while drawing. Yes, there's a lot of like there's a lot of acting going on as well. So yeah, I try to make it as visual as I can. I stole this system from the creative team that made Samurai Jack.
Oh, okay, nice.
Because their focus was on visual storytelling first. So they wouldn't write script. They would make the storyboards directly, and that's how they would figure out the story. And that's exactly how I do it. And yeah, it does have a huge. It does help a lot to figure out, like even just how do I manage the beats of a scene or page or an entire chapter. It's really good to have like you have the space in front of you, the size of the page, and you can figure out. There are certain ideas of how to make a scene go down that you would not have if you're writing it. Because sometimes you can convey so much just because the panel is rectangular and standing upwards that you would not necessarily have in mind when you're writing a script. It is all these different little details that make it work the way it does.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I just really, again, as a word first person, that's how I read. So when I read a comic, it's always words first. But with this book, I caught myself pretty early on, not like even on my first read, just really absorbing the story visually. And you have some silent panels, obviously, so that makes it easier when there's a silent panel. But even then, and I think it's almost because of the way that you drop the silent panels in there, after there was like one with like three pages in a row, I think, where they're silent. And then when I came back out of that, I realized I was absorbing the pictures before I was reading the words. And so by the time I got to the end, I flipped my whole comic reading style because you're telling such a visual story. And again, your characters are so expressive. I never worry how they're feeling because I know I see it. It's right there. It's always funny when you are drawing these expressive characters and then they're having a miscommunication. And I'm like, dude, are you just looking at her? How do you not see what she's thinking? And so there's that other commentary that you're making about the way humans don't communicate, because you're drawing people where anybody who's looking at knows exactly, oh, he's mad, she's hiding something, whatever. And they, inside their own story, can't get out of their own head. So it's really clever too, whether that was intentional or not. I get that feeling. It's like, when you draw such amazing characters and they can't read each other, there's a difference. There's something else going on that's blocking them. So I really love that too. Nice. It was great. Let's talk about the colors. You colored it yourself. It has a very distinct color palette. Obviously, you know, because you did it. And then each section has its own thing. So again, was that in the original draft, or is that after you're done, you're like, okay, I need this section of the story needs to be colored this way, because it's, and even when you're in the flashbacks, when she's telling the story, the coloring changes slightly. So is that in the original draft, or is that a back end?
It was all planned.
Oh, it was?
No, not necessarily all. There's an entire section of like muscle dreaming at one point.
Yeah.
That wasn't there in the original layouts.
Oh.
And I think it's Sebastian Gerner, the editor, who sent me a message saying, I think we need something there to like sort of give a bit of background or whatever. And one of the games that I love to play with him is that he will send me a message saying, we need this. Can you have it done by next week? And then I send a full layout an hour later. He's like, okay, I don't have any notes, go on.
Yeah,
I love that. It's really good for the ego too.
Yeah.
But nice. Yeah, he said like we need a sequence just to show like a bit of background in this situation. And I had the idea of to do it as a dream sequence, and the way it's drawn down to the coloring was all chosen on the fly. Whereas everything else in that chapter was chosen beforehand, because I really wanted to play with the coloring of it, because they're supposed to be in a place that's been destroyed. And so I wanted more muted colors. So I would literally just draw the page, color everything, and then desaturate all the colors except like red.
Wow. That's awesome.
I really pushed it.
And there's a black and white section.
Yeah, as well.
So it's like right in the middle, the interlude. You're like, now for an interlude, no color either. Ha ha! You're like, what? It's like, it's so cool. Yeah.
Because it was based on an episode of The Twilight Zone. So it sort of felt right, I guess. And it really cut with the rest. Like I really want you to have this section that sort of, I want you to know that it's not apart from the rest necessarily, but like it's a different story that ties into the rest and you need to pay attention. And yeah, so the rest of the book was the coloring of everything else was chosen because green was supposed to represent magic, for example. So I usually have it in situations where someone has a magical power somewhere, especially with Mbam, the pig. Green is present pretty much every time he's around.
Yeah.
The red and yellow were mostly colors for like danger and action. And then the rest is more me. When I visualize stuff, I often have a color in mind for like, this is how I want it to look. And I don't necessarily choose. My brain chooses for me, and then I sort of try to get as close as I can to what I had in my brain.
Well, even your color, the cover is yellow. I was just pulling it up. The covers,
yeah.
And so it's almost like, what's interesting is because there are, like, there's so many greens, like there's so much green in this, and there's so many, but your colors, your cover is yellow. So it's almost like you gift wrap the book. You're like, you're not sure what's inside it. And then you open it up. You're like, what is happening? So I just, it was so fun to read. I loved it so much. It's only 180 pages, but it feels like it's 360. It's not in a bad way. Like sometimes, you know how, and this is the phrase I always use. Sometimes you're like, you tried to get 10 pounds of sand into that 5-pound bag and that's bad. You got like a full novel in 180 pages. And the denseness of it, it doesn't plod, you know, it's like, it's dense and it's layered. And you've given us, like I said, you've written almost three stories right on top of each other. And so depending on where you are, you know how like it is when you're a kid, you read something and you like it. And then you read it later and you're like, you know, 20 years later, you're like, oh, that's a different book. It's the same, you know, like I was 18 and I read that, or I was 8 and now I'm 28, or now I'm 8 and 18 and 28. And you're going to read the same book three times and it's a totally different book. And you've given us that and it's there. So no matter what kind of frame of mind you're in when you read this book, I feel like readers are going to get something different. And I don't think there's no age range on this. I mean, I always end when I say, who do you want to give this to? But you're the creator. So besides yourself, who did you write it for? And do you see an age range? Like, is there anybody who you think, I don't think it's like terrifying in any stretch of the imagination. I would happily hand this to a 12-year-old.
That's kind of how I didn't have an audience in mind, mostly because I didn't want to think about it, and I was just doing the stuff that I wanted to do. And but if I had to like pick, I would say 12 and up, mostly because that's the sort of stuff that I would have wanted to read when I was 12. Like I try to approach it in a way where it's fun, you have action and cool designs and everything, but at the same time you have a story that that doesn't think you're too young or dumb to understand, but also isn't covered wall to wall with like gore and sex and cursing and all that stuff. So I made something that I would want my teenage or 12-year-old self to be able to read and appreciate and come back later when he's older and read again and get something else, just like you said.
Yeah, well, it works. It's I loved it. I'm so glad TKO reached out and they're like, hey, there's this new book. You interested? And I just saw what it was about before I even had a copy of it. I was like, yep, yes, let's do this. I would like to do this. And then they sent me a copy. So, now we're recording. It's officially out here in America. I was just looking, the date is, it was out 2 days ago. So by the time you're listening to this, there'll be a link in the show notes to the Goodreads page. I always link to Goodreads because not only do you get awesome reviews, but at Goodreads, you get links to bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, local bookstores, and your public library, which, you know, if you could get into every public library in America, Judy, then you'd be a bestseller. That's all you need, right? 5,000 sales. So make sure you tell your library to go buy this. And if every library buys a book, then that's good for the artist. This is so good. You've got this other thing coming up that you can't talk about too much or you'll have to kill us. So what's your next solo project that you got out there?
I can't say which company I'm doing this with because it's not been announced yet, but I've been like posting about this project since I was in high school. So like everyone knows, I guess.
it's an open secret. All right.
Yeah, kind of. It's just not, I just never communicated on the fact that I have managed to find a place for it. So the basic is called Monkey Meat, and it's a series of, either 24 pages or 32 pages of short stories set in a world where it's an island that's owned by a mega corporation that sells processed monkey meat in cans. And they use the money that they make to sort of perform loads of different supernatural experiments on the ecosystem of the island, creating all kinds of monsters and weird things. And instead of trying to hide it, they actually use it as a tourism argument, saying, come to our hotel, visit the island, see all the weird stuff we have. And so every issue has, or every chapter has a different story. It's an anthology of however many stories I want to do, where you follow a different character trying to live in what's essentially a sort of weird guerrilla-style hyper-capitalist world where you can drink a can of soda and get superpowers, and or you turn on the tap water in your or in your sink and a witch shows up and tries to eat your brains.
Well, so, I'm sold. That sounds amazing. I can't wait to get my hands on that either. Wow. That's awesome. What a cool idea. And you obviously mentioned the Twilight Zone thing. I love the Twilight Zone. So it seems like that's a heavy influence here too. That sounds really genius. That's going to be so fun.
It's sort of funky take on the Twilight Zone, I guess. Like the whole Black Mirror, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Every story is independent. You can read them in whatever order you want. And yeah, so I've been working on this for like years and years. I post designs every once in a while. And once I'm ready, I'm gonna put this out.
Well, I can't wait. That sounds awesome. I will. So that's a good segue. So how will people know? Where should people go to follow Junie so they could be like, I need monkey meat. I need that, which is, I'm a vegetarian. So I just said out loud, I need monkey meat. That's a weird thing to say. But I do, I need that book. So where do people follow you on your social medias? How do people know all your good stuff?
Look for my name on Instagram or Twitter. I mostly recommend Instagram because I just post drawings there. Twitter, I have the bad habit of like talking too much.
That's okay.
So yeah, those two are the main ones.
Okay. And I'll link to those in the show. And it's just @JunieBa both places.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. There's an underscore dot depending on the app, but I haven't had any like issue being found so far. I have an odd name.
Right. So, you weren't like when you were like, I'm going to register it @JunieBa. They weren't like, no one else has this. You didn't have to worry. They're like, you need to have JunieBa one because that JunieBa
right. I think there were like one or two before me, but not enough that it would make it difficult to find me, I guess.
Yeah. Right. So we will link to all those. And do you have and so you post your stuff on Instagram? Do you have like a DeviantArt or a webpage or anything too? Or just
not really. I have a website, but I don't really use it.
You don't like do commissions or anything. If anybody wants
I
to
do.
Like,
oh, I so, do, but not always.
Okay. Just depends on how busy you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, if people, well, I'm going to link to everything because you never know. People are like, hey, I really want this. And if they hit you at the right time, maybe they get a JunieBa original, which would be cool. These are great. TKO, I'm so impressed by them. I mean, they really are the little engine that could, in that they've got the biggest names behind them. Like, they're no joke. It wasn't like, we're going to be this cheeky little upstart. They're like, we're just going to come in and start dropping bombs, and every book is good. And you are now part of another, like, the TKO library is amazing. And so you are now in the TKO group with, you know, just little nobodies like, oh, Jeff Lemire and... you know, Grant Morrison, whatever. No, what have they done? Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Well, now you're up there with them. So congratulations. This book is great. Thank you for sharing it with me. Thank you for your time today. And I always end, well, I got busted for copyright infringement. I'm just going to leave all this right in the show. But because you've brought it up so many times, I feel like it would be wrong of us not to end with a gorilla song. I mean, even just part of a gorilla song. What's your favorite gorilla song? And we'll play that on the way out.
Empire Ends.
Okay, done. I love the Gorillas, by the way. I just think they're so... the first time I heard and saw them, nobody has ever done anything like that. And again, they're so captivating, right? Like you said, every time they're on, you just stop what you're doing and you're like, what? So, well, thank you. So everybody, you can follow me on Twitter. You can go to my website, arfarina.com. Thank you again, Junie. And here is Gorillas, Empire Ants. See everybody next time.
drums of the wind. The polyphonic prayer is here, it's all around you, it's all around you, out here, and if the whole world is crashing down. Out of my memory, where the emptiness we leave behind, on air rising, blows all the shadows far away.